1492, Columbus discovered America. Many people believe that his first contact was with the Indians. Well, that isn't quite true. In fact, a very bizarre and never revealed story did, in fact, occur. While Columbus and his men disembarked from the Mayflower and the Santa Maria, Zechariah, Columbus's book boy, wrote in his diary, which he kept in his pillow, he said, "A warning came from the beachhead. It was heard all throughout the area. Here comes the colonel. Here comes the colonel."
Okay, okay, enjoy your gag. Saying I've been around since Columbus. I don't think Columbus embarked from the Mayflower. That should have been a tip-off of it being bogus. Well, welcome back. The second half hour, the promise of tomorrow, here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. A lot of exciting things happening in this half hour. Mark Showalter, the senior research scientist at the Carl Sagan Center of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, is calling in looking for names for the moons for Pluto. And then Bill Wattenberg of Lawrence Livermore Lab is going to stop in and tell us about the things that he's put together about stopping runaway tanker trucks that could be hijacked. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments to the Voice of Reason. Right now, though, let's step over to our fountain of useless information and see about today's query. Hang around a coin jar here a little bit.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Ah, yes, we've aroused the old spirit of the fountain once again by throwing in the coins. All right, old spirit of the fountain, here's today's query. A little history for you here. Who was the first lady to preside at a press conference for women reporters? The first lady presiding at a press conference for women reporters. Who was it, O Spirit of the Fountain?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
The Spirit of the Fountain knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all. Well, the first lady presided at a press conference for women reporters. If you said Jacqueline Kennedy, you're wrong. It was Eleanor Roosevelt. That's right, Eleanor Roosevelt. All right, back to today's guest. Ah, yes, the Science News Network studio band as we wait for Mark Showalter of SETI to phone in about naming the moons of Pluto. Science News Radio Network.
Hi, is this Colonel Mason?
Yeah, right. Is this Mark Showalter?
Yes, it is.
Great, Mark. Thanks so much for calling. You're really pretty close to being right on time, too. Thank you so much.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm pretty fascinated with this. You're going to let the public submit their ideas of names for Pluto's moons, at least two of Pluto's, five moons, I guess?
That's right, yes.
Okay, so you're going to let the public submit names for two of Pluto's five moons that you've discovered. That seems like a very generous thing to do, because you could name them after your mother, I suppose, or your girlfriend, or something of that nature.
Yeah, it's the minions of Hades, so it's probably any of my friends or family members would be insulted if I chose to name the moons after any of them.
Well, I wasn't sure I understood you fully. Did you say it is in the dominion of Hades? Is that what I heard you say?
The minions of Hades. The names come from Greek mythology, and they're all related to Hades and the underworld. So anyway, they're not necessarily nice set of characters from which we're choosing names. There's, you know, monsters and three-headed dogs and the Furies, which were these little gods that would torment people. These are the kinds of names we're choosing from to name the moons of Pluto.
So your mother and your girlfriend wouldn't appreciate being in that company. That's what you're saying?
Exactly, exactly.
All right. Now, this is the other thing too. Then you want people to submit suggestions of names from Greek mythology, but you want them to all be sort of related to the dominion of Hades. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. that's correct. And I could say we're already getting some really great suggestions. I've been following the list of submissions as they come in, and some very, very thoughtful ideas are coming in from people all over the world. It's been very interesting already.
Well, if you're restricting it to Greek mythology and the dominion of Hades, I mean, you're probably going to get 14,000 suggestions of about the same names, aren't you?
You would be surprised how many names there are to choose from. It's a very large number. There are, all I could really suggest is try going on to Wikipedia or a site like that and start reading about mythology. And there's a large set, and we've already chosen. I think we have about 10 names on the ballot at the moment that are just names that we, as the group who made the discovery, came up with. But I don't want the ballot to get too long, but we're certainly hoping to add a couple of names based on what people have submitted.
Well, Mark, that answers my question: why you didn't switch over to maybe names from ancient Egypt, like Akhenaten or Nefertiti or something like that.
Yeah. So there is the International Astronomical Union actually defines the set of rules for how we name the moons around each planet, and so we are basically complying by those rules as established by the international community, and we can't really go off and change the rules. We have to work with that. But I can certainly say that in a couple of years we've got a spacecraft called New Horizons that will be reaching Pluto, and at that point we'll be naming craters and mountains and all kinds of landforms on the surface of Pluto. And I think that's when we'll have the chance to start bringing in all these other great mythologies, and as we start naming the features that are on Pluto and its moon Charon.
Well, the ancient Greeks had absolutely no idea that someday their storytelling would reach out into moons around some planet they didn't even know exist. Now, wait a minute, and then that's another question. Now, I got to ask this because when I was growing up, there were 9 planets, and Pluto was the last one. And Pluto has been recently reduced to something other than a planet. I don't know. Is it not a planet anymore? Is it an asteroid?
It is the official term is a dwarf planet, and some people see that as a demotion, but the fact is it's a very, very small object compared to the other 8 planets, and I just kind of see it as a description of what it is. It's just like a planet, except it's a whole lot smaller, but it's still a very interesting object. It's still got moons that need to be named. And so whether it's called a dwarf planet or not, doesn't really change anything as far as astronomers are concerned.
Okay, well, then it's still a planet, but it's a dwarf planet, and you're getting really picky by putting it in these categories. When Karen Randall got a hold of me and said that you were looking for names for Pluto's moons, I thought, this small planet and moons, what are they, the size of basketballs or something? But these, I guess, are a little bigger than basketballs, aren't they?
Oh, no, these are, we wouldn't see basketballs, but it's a very long way away to Pluto. These objects are, sort of 20 to 30 kilometers, so that would be maybe 15, 20 miles across, probably. We don't really know their sizes very well.
Yeah.
But, they're certainly, I live in San Francisco area, these objects are probably kind of the order of the size of City of San Francisco, maybe a little smaller, perhaps, and so that's the size of object we're talking about.
You think when that spacecraft gets closer to Pluto, they're going to find objects circling it that are the size of basketballs? Huh? Is that going to happen? And then we're going to try to name those.
I don't think even New Horizons could see something the size of basketballs, but certainly it will be able to see things much smaller than P4 and P5. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if we're coming up with names for P6, P7, and P8 a couple of years from now. But right now, these are the objects that we can see from Earth with the best telescopes we've got, which in this case is the Hubble telescope. So P4 and P5 are the only moons we're going to know about until New Horizons gets there.
All right. Well, when you when you make your decisions, I hope you'll give me a call back again and we can make the announcement of these names here on the Science News Radio Network, because I know our listeners are waiting with bated breath and on the edge of their seats to try to find out what from Greek mythology, what names from Hades has been chosen. Will you do that?
Well, we will. We'll be making an announcement. That, by the way, so since we have to get the names, so we have to select, we'll base our choices on the top of getting names, but then we have to propose those names to the international community, which then has to approve them. So it'll be a couple, 1 or 2 months, I'm going to say, guessing, after we close the voting, before that, we'll make that announcement. But, you'll certainly hear about it.
All right, I appreciate that. And of course, we've been following things that are going on at SETI for a long time. You're still enlisting people to use their computers to try to pick up communications, radio signals, and that sort of thing from outer space. Is that still going on?
I believe they are. The SETI at Home project is, I think, what you're talking about. That mm-hmm. was actually, I mean, we have close ties with a group at Berkeley, and it's actually the Berkeley group that has run SETI at Home. But I believe it's still an active program. I'm just not an expert on that, I'm afraid.
All right. Well, best of luck to you. I appreciate you calling in today. Mark Showalter, Senior Research Scientist at the Carl Sagan Center of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good talking to you, Colonel. Bye.
Okay, since we talk a lot about Homeland Security in this program, I want to tell you about Bill Wattenberg. He's a scientist for Lawrence Livermore Labs. He's also a talk radio host on a rival network, talkradionetwork1.com. And Bill has done some pretty remarkable things in his life and his time at Lawrence Livermore. One is to be able to find a way to defeat a runaway hijacked tanker trucks that could cause a whole bunch of damage and being able to stop them cold. And he's explaining that to us a little bit. And also things that have been done to clear minefields using helicopters and chains. And so we caught up with Bill on his cell phone.
Now, what about this? What about this? This stopping runaway trucks with a thing on the back bumper that a police car can bump the runaway truck and stop the truck. Tell me about that.
Easiest thing in the world. Thoroughly test. You can see it again in the video right at the Nevada test site. Big officials from Washington were there. CHP loved it. The minute they asked the state legislature to put it in trial basis on fuel tanker trucks, the Trucking Association came in and screamed like hell with their lobbyists that it was an unnecessary expense. So you just wait until these terrorists take a fuel tanker truck on a bridge and kill a couple of thousand, then the bastards are all one of yesterday, you see.
Yeah, that's how it works, isn't it? That seems to be how it works.
Oh, yeah, the dirt, it's being used overseas. The Israelis wrapped it up immediately, and so the others, because the scheme we found is dirt cheap. It's literally like $300 to put on a fuel tanker truck just because, you know, $3 billion worth of damage if a terrorist got it. And the cops love it because if you look at the video, it gives them total control of these big tanker trucks. The driver can't do a damn thing about it.
Yeah, well, I would think that's a great Homeland Security issue, and it should be something brought up for Homeland Security.
It has been, and the trucking industry and others are in there deflecting it every time with their lobbyists and senators. We don't think this is necessary. There's been no real threat so far. Well, the dumb shit, this is an age-old story. There was never a 9/11 before either, was there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Scrambled to modify all the airplanes for, $300,000 a piece and doors and things, and here's $300 for a truck. But it's very real. Again, the video's there, the full test tapes of how it's done. Turns out that it dawned on me that there is a mechanism in the air brake system of every truck that is duck suit to use, and nobody thought about it. Okay? And it comes about this way, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but in air brakes on big trucks, you're not applying air pressure to the brakes, the safety system. You're removing the air pressure for it to activate. There's a safety system, in other words, built into the air brakes, such that if you lose air pressure, the brakes are turned on. That's what makes trucks so stable and safe. You actually have to start one up and run the air pressure up to operating levels before you can move. Well, it just dawned on me, all we have to do is tickle that safety mechanism and make it lose a little air pressure, and it'll set the brakes up on the trailer.
Wow, that's brilliant, yeah.
That's all that bumper does. And the easiest thing in the world is for a cop car to bump the back, because you see, a big truck can't move quickly, can't change speed quickly. And patrol car, just the easiest thing in the world to go up and bump one with no harm, no dent, no problem whatsoever.
Well, how about somebody that's going to hijack one of those vehicles, one of those tanker trucks, and run it into something, but beforehand goes and defeats the mechanism sitting on the bumper, like takes a sledgehammer or something and knocks it off? I mean, what about that?
Then he doesn't go anywhere because he has just set the brakes up. That's the beauty of it.
So it can't be easily defeated then.
No, because the minute you knock the mechanism off in the back that the patrol car bumps, you set the brakes on the trailer. You can't release them even if you run the air pressure up because you've got a leaking air hose.
Well, can you wire around it, but I guess actually you do plumbing around it. I mean, could you do that?
If somebody knew where the lines go and got under there with tools and did it, you know, was deliberately obvious for a half hour or so, they could re-plumb around the device we put on the truck. See? That's no concern because the trucks are watched, monitored. What the threat is, a tanker truck gets hijacked in transit, you know what I mean?
Mm.
You're a legal, secure driver and you drive it into a service station or someplace or you park for a minute and it's hijacked right there and they take off. See? Well, they don't have the opportunity to rewire the truck.
Yeah.
That's what the CHP liked about it. In fact, they can tell you the former commissioner of the California Highway Patrol, probably one of the top cops in the country, that loved it, and he was livid that the trucking lobby refused to try it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now, tell me about the helicopters with the... The minefields. They drag something through the minefield from a helicopter that sits off the mines. Is that how it works?
Again, look at the video. Now I got you. The YouTube video shows you the tests in Oregon, out in the Oregon Badlands, and the Yuma Proving Ground. But the main problem with clearing minefields is a very simple concept. Anything you put on the ground trying to clear the mines, well, you'll eventually get killed, okay? Any iron you put down there is eventually going to get blown apart because the bad news is the other guys make anti-tank mines strong enough to blow the belly out of an M1A1 tank, you see.
Mm.
So all the schemes of having chains in front of a tank flailing along and what have you, they eventually all get killed. The thing we realized at Livermore is the only thing that could be done would be to build something that we can drag on the ground from a distance. You know what I mean? You're not there when the mine explodes.
Mm-hmm.
And that something has to be indestructible. Well, we discovered a thing called a chain matrix. And what it is imagine a blanket. But the blanket is made out of loose chain segments, like a coat of mail. You know, you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It has tines going down in the ground that dig in the ground to contact the mines, to dig them up. And when one of them explodes, that chain matrix isn't ripped apart. It just is blown up in the air and settled back down again with very little harm. And because it obeys a concept in physics that we know about, goes back to the Mossbauer effect, but if you have something like a crystal, where all the segments share in the momentum that's put into the system, then you don't break any one part. Well, that's what that chain matrix accomplishes, and we actually did a lot of testing to develop that at Livermore. Then the next step came fine. Now we need to pull it at a distance, such that as the mines are exploding under it, you don't get killed. You don't have personnel around. Well, that's the obvious there was a big helicopter. The Navy's been using them over water for 30 years. In fact, commercial interests use them in logging woods and everywhere. You can pick up 20 tons on these big helicopters with a long line 500 to 1,000 feet long. So we put those two concepts together, and it works very well.
And the reason they're not used more widely is because of the expense of the helicopter. And you're saying the United Nations should pick that up. Is that right?
Yeah, because the third world countries won't put out the 5,000 or more per hour to operate a helicopter, and maybe 500,000 to get it there. You see? And so lives are cheaper. In fact, even after the Gulf War, well, look, we were heavily involved in the first Gulf War. I'm the guy, by the way, that was sent by the U.S. Department of Energy to help put out the Clay Oil fires. I think you remember those. All that history is written up, by the way, in the university reports that I sent to. Just go to www.wattenberg.us, and there's a university report there of all these projects and adventures. And anyway, I was over there putting out the Kuwaiti oil well fires, and the Kuwaitis and their contractors wouldn't even use this helicopter to clear the mines out of the open desert areas, which is duck soup, because it was a lot cheaper to hire Pakistani soldiers.
Oh, jeez.
And they only killed about 30 of them in a year's time there. Yeah. But, you know, they could get Pakistani soldiers for $20 a day and line them up with rods to crawl on the ground and go find the mines. So that's what they did. There were simple solutions when you really sit out and said, look, let's look at all the infrastructure we have. How can we put some of it together to solve this problem? Up to the time we tackled the minefield thing, the Pentagon's attitude was there wasn't anything you do about it. It's the risk soldiers have to take. And we said, bullshit, you know, you get out and do something.
Well, Bill, you make a lot of sense, and I want to thank you a whole lot for having the conversation with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, hey, it's delighted you called, and appreciate talking to you. Get a hold of me anytime. You've got my cell number here. And
all right, I appreciate it a whole bunch, Bill. Thanks a bunch. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Well, the only thing I see is the only thing I don't want to see. If you're familiar with Conflicker or Stuxnet, if someone were to launch a denial of service on a major internet pop and take the internet down, say, you know, they say 90% of all internet comes through the United States at some point. So if they slowed that down 30%, you know, you wouldn't be able to use your Easy Pass to go through the toll. You wouldn't be able to pay for the gas at the pump or check out of the hotel or cash your passport through to get on an airplane. And as soon as the internet slowed down and all those people were queuing up, people would start clicking more and only aggravate the situation. That's the thing I think about at night, which is not a pretty picture. Robin Gamble, the CEO of Persistent Telecom.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.